I'm Andrew Davis, music director of Lyric Opera of Chicago, and those were the first several bars of Jules Massenet's Don Quixote. I'll be talking about the composer and his opera, but first, a little background. In the 19th century, French musicians put their hopes in the theatre as the surest path to fame and fortune. For the French public, the opera was as much a social event as a musical experience. Prosperous families who otherwise had little interest in music were regularly in attendance. The audience for opera constituted a well-defined public, and the composer who could please everyone, or at least nearly everyone, in a house that seated over 2,000 patrons, was richly rewarded. In 19th century France, composing a successful opera was similar to writing a successful screenplay in 20th century America. For much of the 1800s, French opera was synonymous with grand opera. Five-act extravaganzas that involved stirring historical subjects, large casts, gigantic choruses, lavish scenery, and maybe even pyrotechnics. In other words, lots of eye candy and a good deal of appealing music. Dominating the French operatic scene for many years was Giacomo Meyerbeer, a German-Jewish immigrant who, with his Les Huguenots, Le Prophète, and L'Africaine, established the template for all this sensual pageantry. Gradually, as the century wore on, three French composers, Gounod, Bizet, and Massenet, turned away from grand opera. They shied away from historical subjects and theatrical excesses, and instead focused on intimate dramas. Besides being French, all three had, in different years, won the famous French prize, the Prix de Rome, and each had studied and spent substantial time in the Eternal City. Bizet, the composer of The Pearl Fishers and Carmen, died in 1875. Gounod, who wrote the ever-popular Faust and Romeo and Juliet, lived until 1893. It was Massenet, famous for Manon and Werther, who lived well into the 20th century. His Don Quixote premiered in 1910, the same year as Stravinsky's Firebird. But despite writing 10 operas after 1900 and living more than a full decade into the 20th century, Massenet never abandoned his roots in French Romanticism. He was a true child of the 19th century. The new styles that emerged after 1900 were not for him. No atonal meanderings or flirtation with 20th century realism. Massenet was a straight-ahead, Romantic-era composer who clung to the Romantic ideal that had brought him so much acclaim in the 1880s, wonderful melodies and touching stories. And yet, his influence can be heard in Debussy, Ravel, and even Poulenc. For a time in the 20th century, Massenet was largely forgotten, except for Manon and Werther. But after several decades, the other Massenet pieces were rediscovered. Don Quixote is certainly one of them, the 21st of his 25 operas and the last great box office success of his career. Like all his works, it demonstrates exquisite musical craftsmanship and a complete mastery of orchestration. His fellow French composer Camille Saint-Saëns wrote in 1873, "Massenet's music is original without being outlandish, and diverting without being frivolous. This is more than enough to assure success." Upon examination, one discovers, not without astonishment, that it derives from Gounod without sounding at all like him. It is basically Gounod, but condensed, refined, and crystallized. Closer to our time, Sir Thomas Beecham wrote, "I would give the whole of Bach's Brandenburg Concertos for Massenet's Manon, and would think I had vastly profited in the exchange." Massenet wrote his first opera in 1867 and his last in 1912. During his lifetime, he was the most highly regarded of all French opera composers. His catalogue contains 30 stage works along with ballets, piano pieces, choral works, and more than 200 songs. He was forever industrious, and he had the courage to be prolific. As soon as he'd finished one composition, he'd begin toiling on the next, and he reaped substantial monetary rewards from all his industriousness. Composing operas made him wealthy. His earnings were similar to Verdi's and Puccini's. His father, Alexis, managed an iron foundry 36 miles southwest of Lyon. His company made scythes. But these weren't just any scythes. They were shown at the Paris Exposition of 1844 and won for Alexis the decoration of Chevalier of the Légion d'Honneur. Alexis Massenet was also an inventor. As Jules recounted in an 1892 article in Century magazine, my father became an ironmaster and was the inventor of those huge hammers which, crushing steel with extraordinary power by a single blow, change bars of metal into sickles and scythes. It was to the sounds of heavy hammers that Jules Massenet was born. But those were not the only sounds that young Massenet heard. While his father was an industrialist, his mother was a pianist. The family moved to Paris in early 1848, and it was there that young Jules began lessons with her. The first of these lessons occurred on February the 24th of that year, a day that Massenet and many others would never forget. He may have been born to the sounds of heavy hammers, but he was introduced to music to the accompaniment of small arms fire. His first piano lesson was interrupted by gunshots in the street. It was that day that the Revolution of 1848 began. Despite the revolution and the hard times endured by his family, young Massenet continued studying with his mother. In 1853, he took the entrance exam to the Paris Conservatory, playing the finale of Beethoven's Sonata, Opus 29. At the age of 10 years and 7 months, he was admitted to a piano class there. He continued at the conservatory for a number of years, eventually supporting himself by playing timpani in theatre orchestras. At the start, Massenet was a lazy student, but inspired by his teacher Ambroise Thomas, he began working hard at his studies. In 1863, he won the Académie des Beaux-Arts Prix de Rome with his cantata David Rizzio. The Prix de Rome carried with it a stipend. Massenet would spend several years studying in Rome and travelling about Europe with prize money that amounted to 3,000 francs per year. With money like that, Massenet was freed from the orchestra pit. "I began to live," he said of his time in Rome. "During my happy walks with my comrades, painters, sculptors, and in our talks under the oaks of the Villa Borghese or under the pines of Villa Pamphili, I felt my first stirrings and admiration for nature and for art." Despite his many years in Italy, Massenet's operas are as French as a baguette. Instead of large scenes inflated way beyond their importance to the narrative, and instead of many overwrought climaxes, Massenet gives us beautiful melodies. His music is poetry that's tinged with melancholy, and it's seductive, beguiling, delicate, sensitive, and always appealing. His first great success with opera came in 1877 with Le Roi de Lahore, an opera in 5 acts and 7 scenes, which was more French grand opera than anything else. The scenery and costumes were opulent, as was Massenet's orchestration, which employed the usual size orchestra, augmented by saxophones. At the premiere, the President of the Republic sat in one box, and in another, the Emperor of Brazil. Massenet awoke the morning after the premiere to rave reviews in all the Paris newspapers. He was compared to the composers of Fidelio, Der Freischütz, Tannhäuser, and William Tell. Not bad for a man of 35. His Manon came in 1884, Werther in 1892, and Thaïs 2 years later. Massenet believed that the way to artistic excellence was through the composing of a solid body of grand-scale works. These, of course, would be produced over many years, and that's what he did. Massenet composed constantly and enjoyed a long career with many triumphs. But not all his works were successful. The Massenet opera that came immediately before Don Quixote was Bacchus, which opened in Monte Carlo in the spring of 1909. It was the greatest setback of Massenet's musical life. A Sanskrit-inspired epic containing an interlude that depicts a battle between the monkeys of the Indian forest and the forces of Bacchus. The monkeys even throw rocks. While he was writing it, Massenet visited the Paris Zoo several times to observe monkeys up close. He took great care in his musical depiction of simians, but it didn't matter, the opera was a flop. It received 6 performances and has never been seen again. The reviews were so bad that when Massenet read them, he burst into tears. The pain of Bacchus never left him, and if emotional distress weren't enough, he was then stricken with a severe attack of rheumatism, which confined him to bed for several weeks. But no pain, neither emotional or physical, could stop him. He had a desk constructed that allowed him to write while in bed, and he soon began work on Don Quixote. He was 67 and referred to his work on Don Quixote as a soothing balm. Scholars consider the original Don Quixote story by Cervantes one of the most influential works of literature from the Spanish literary canon and one of the greatest works of fiction ever written. The story is about a man who reads so many chivalry-filled novels that he becomes delusional and sets out to undo wrongs and bring justice to the world under the name Don Quixote de la Mancha. He recruits a simple farmer, Sancho Panza, as his squire, and the two have numerous adventures. One of Strauss's most splendid orchestral works is based also on this story. Massenet's Don Quixote is in five short acts with a libretto by Henri Caïn, who based it not on the original novel, but on a verse drama written by poet Jacques Le Lurion. Le Chevalier de la Longue Figure was first performed in Paris in 1904. Le Lurion was the son of a shoemaker. He had come to Paris from the country with a dream of supporting himself with his poetry. He attracted the attention of other poets and influential citizens, but one day he suddenly renounced literary fame and opened a cobbler shop in the Latin Quarter. He was indeed his father's son, or so he thought. His shop was frequented by the curious, people wanting to see the cobbler poet at work, but his flirtation with his father's trade soon ended. He abandoned his workbench and returned to poetry. But now he was broke, and soon became seriously ill, lapsing into a near comatose state. While he lay on his sickbed, his Le Chevalier de la Longue Figure was produced and quickly became a sensation. Determined to see his work on stage, he was carried to the theatre. There he willed himself to remain conscious through the performance. He did, but he died a few days later. The story that Le Lurion and Massenet present to the audience is considerably different from the one by Cervantes. The title character is a sweet old man, kind, magnanimous, and idealistic, a champion of goodness. And Dulcinée, the simple peasant woman of the novel, is transformed into a sophisticated and flirtatious lady, a courtesan who beguiles the old knight and inspires his exploits. Despite its five acts, the opera contains less than 2 hours of music. The first act takes place in the public square in front of Dulcinée's house. A crowd of her admirers fills the square and they sing of her beauty. Don Quixote and Sancho arrive and are greeted with shouts of derision at their ridiculous appearance. Don Quixote is wearing a rusting suit of armour and Sancho rides a donkey. Despite their reception by the locals, the knight serenades the lady, but is interrupted by the jealous Juan, one of the lady's four suitors. A duel is prevented by Dulcinée, who tells the knight she will consider him if he recovers a necklace that has been stolen from her. Here's some of that serenade. I should mention that the recorded examples used here are from the Erato recording with Teresa Berganza, José Fondam, and Alain Fondary, with Le Chœur du Capitole de Toulouse and L'Orchestre du Capitole de Toulouse, conducted by Michel Plasson. In the second act, the Don is mounted on a horse and Sancho on a donkey. They search the countryside for the bandits. The Don improvises a love song to Dulcinée while Sancho shares his anti-feminist feelings. As in the Cervantes novel, the Don mistakes some windmills for giants, charges at them, and is carried aloft on one of the blades. This music is delightful and shows Massenet's wonderful ability as an orchestrator.
Sancho, au garde, quoi la basse dressée dans le fond au palais, le terrible géant. Maître, c'est un moulin illustre, c'est légion, il a leur arrogance, tente de m'arrêter, quelle est leur insolence, je vais les châtier, au fatal divorce, le pauvre recommence.
Third act, they encounter the bandits. Sancho flees, but Don Quixote puts up a respectable defense. Despite his efforts, he's taken prisoner and treated roughly by the bandits, who make plans to kill him. But he comforts himself by repeating the name Dulcinea, and he so impresses them with his earnestness, simplicity, patience, and courage that they are overcome. They not only give him the necklace, but ask for his blessing. Here's the last few minutes of Act Three.
Je suis le chevalier errant et qui redresse l'état. Un vagabond inondé de tendresse pour les mères en deuil et que du sang, une part.
Voici le joyau dérobé, mon seigneur.
Bien, merci. Sancho, ristre, au cœur timoré, viens voir le miracle opéré, viens. Les manants, les pillards, fils du vol et du crime, ce que la peur redoute et que la force opprime, les gueux au rire menaçant ont deviné mon but en ont saisi le sort pour mes soldats qui viennent si hautes tremblant de grands frissons. Regarde-les, mes hôtes, les élus de mon cœur, mes fils prédestinés, voilà-les, mes fils comme ils sont, dans
The fourth act opens with a celebration at Dulcinea's house. There's music and dancing, but despite this, Dulcinea is melancholy. Eventually, though, she shakes it off, grabs a guitar and sings, Ne pensons qu'au plaisir d'aimer. Let's just think of the pleasures of love. Everyone's astonishment, the knight and Sancho show up with the necklace. Dulcinea throws her arms around him, and in the delusional haze that he inhabits, the old knight asks her to marry him on the spot. She laughs at this, and then confesses that she's not a pure woman, and is in no hurry to give up the pleasures of her present life. The guests don't help things. They too laugh at the old man, actually go as far as to openly ridicule him, which only adds to his depression. He is nothing but a madman posing as a martyr, Juan says. Yes, perhaps this is mad, but his madness is sublime, says Dulcinea, who regrets her cruelty towards him. She shares an intimate moment with the old knight and says that she has opened her heart to him. But Don Quixote sees the futility of it all. This act ends with a deeply moving cello solo, which conveys the despondency that Don Quixote carries with him. I wonder, is it a coincidence that Strauss chose the cello to portray his hero too? In the last act, he's in the forest, alone except for Sancho, who's at his side. He dies, lance in hand, while gazing at a far-off star and hearing the voice of Dulcinea in the distance. Here's the very end of the opera.
qui je veux. Qui me fait signe. Qui m'attend.
Massenet identified personally with his comic heroic protagonist, as he was in love with Lucie Arbel, who sang Dulcinée at the first performance. The role of Don Quixote was one of the most memorable achievements of the Russian bass Fyodor Chalyapin. Massenet specially conceived it for him. On learning that the role was being created for him, Chalyapin called on Massenet and found him to be an elderly man with grey hair and eyes that were so lustrous and shining that Chalyapin said he must take his eyes out each night before bed and leave them standing in a bowl of oil. Don Quixote was premiered in Monte Carlo on February the 19th, 1910. The Chicago premiere of the work, by the Chicago Grand Opera Company, took place in the Auditorium Theatre in January of 1914 and featured Mary Garden. Lyric has presented Don Quixote in 1974, 1981 and 1993. Massenet certainly is the successor to Gounod, and while he broke no new ground with his composition, the tradition that he carried on is significant in French music. As I said earlier, his influence can certainly be found in the music of Debussy and Ravel. And 2 months after Massenet's death in 1912, Saint-Saëns wrote this of him. Others speak lightly of Massenet's works as pleasing, as though this were a deprecation. But is it so reprehensible to please? We admire the art of the Greeks. It was not profound. Their marble goddesses were beautiful, and beauty suffices. A master of his craft, knowing all the secrets of his art, Massenet eschewed those contortions and exaggerations which the naive confuse with musical science. He pursued the path which he himself laid out, profiting from new forms of expression imported from abroad, which he assimilated perfectly as an artist who remained completely French. One final note. Massenet composed constantly for his entire adult life. Many days he laboured on his opera scores for 12 or 14 hours. At his request, there was no music performed at his funeral service. He was finally at rest. This commentary script was prepared by Jack Zimmerman.